From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Today, we continue our series of interviews with Academy Award nominees. We feature our interview with actor Paul Giamatti. He stars in The Holdovers and is nominated for Best Actor for his role as a pompous and disliked teacher at a boys' boarding school in the 70s. The character also has a body odor disorder.
The hair and makeup people, they said to me, I can't believe it, bathe as little as possible if you can.
Also, we remember comic and actor Richard Lewis, who died Tuesday. He told Terry about faking illness as a kid.
It was like a hypochondriacal kabuki theater I put on for the family. And I had different makeups for different ailments, of course.
And Justin Chang reviews Dune Part 2. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A key hearing is underway in a criminal case against former President Donald Trump in Florida. The presumptive GOP presidential nominee is fighting charges that he unlawfully withheld and concealed classified documents after he left office. A federal judge will decide whether to grant Trump's request to delay the trial, currently scheduled for May. Here's NPR's Greg Allen.
U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee, has pushed back previous deadlines and is considering scheduling a hearing to allow Trump's lawyers to argue that the prosecution by Special Counsel Jack Smith is politically motivated. The lawyers also are seeking to have the case dismissed because of presidential immunity, a claim now scheduled for arguments in the Supreme Court. The special counsel wants Judge Cannon to dismiss those claims and a motion by Trump to disclose the names of potential witnesses before they testify. Prosecutors say disclosing the names would subject them to potential threats, intimidation, and harassment. With all this, legal experts say there's a good chance the trial will be postponed. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Protesters in Israel have been calling for early elections in the country and for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to step down. In a speech last night, Netanyahu made his case against holding elections now. We have more from NPR's Dee Parvaz.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned against what he called extremist demands for elections, saying that an early vote during the war would, quote, mean defeat for Israel. Netanyahu is trying to avert a potential political crisis around an issue that could bring down his coalition and force new elections, whether to continue exempting ultra-Orthodox Jews from the military draft. He signaled support for enlisting ultra-Orthodox men into the military, with the current stay on compulsory service for ultra-Orthodox Jews expiring on March 31st. The move might anger Netanyahu's ultra-Orthodox supporters in the parliament, who helped form the coalition that has given the prime minister a narrow majority. Dee Parvaz, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Whiteout blizzard conditions are forecast for portions of Northern California and Nevada. It's expected to bring hurricane-force wind gusts at higher elevations. Yesterday, officials issued a warning for high avalanche danger for the central Sierra Nevada mountains. Bob Orovec, lead forecaster with the National Weather Service in College Park, Maryland, projects as much as 8 feet of snowfall, that is, by the time the weekend is over.
Anywhere in the Sierra, they get the Tahoe, there's going to be huge impacts with respect to the snow. It'll be very heavy snow across the air, measured in the feet range. So anytime you get that kind of snow totals, and there's going to be a lot of wind with it also. There are blizzard warnings out through much of the Sierra. So travel will be pretty much impossible.
That's Bob Orovec, lead forecaster with the National Weather Service. You're listening to NPR News. A simple new test measuring the presence of climate change on screen is being piloted on the nominated feature films at this year's Academy Awards. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the climate reality check is based on a famous test which looks at the representation of women on screen.
Oscar nominees Barbie, Naiad, and Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 all passed the new climate reality check.
It's going to be a shooting war. It's going to be a ballistic war over a rapidly shrinking ecosystem. It's going to be a war for the last of our dwindling energy, drinkable water, breathable air.
Created by the storytelling consultancy Good Energy and Colby College in Maine, the test measures whether climate change is present in a movie's plot and whether at least one character shows awareness of it. Movies also also need to be set on Earth in the present or future to be considered. These rules disqualify more than half of the 31 features up for Academy Awards in 2024, including stories set in the past like Killers of the Flower Moon, with its important message about the dangers of fossil fuels. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Well, U.S. stocks are trading higher this hour as markets consider the latest snapshot of an inflation gauge favored by the Federal Reserve. Increased 0.3% from December to January, up from 0.1% the previous month. Prices were up just 2.4% from a year earlier. That's down from that 2.6% annual pace in December. The Dow is up 38 points. S&P's risen 20. The Nasdaq is up 98 points. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Oscar.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. We're counting down to the Academy Awards. The film Holdovers is nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, Supporting Actress, Original Screenplay, and Best Actor for Paul Giamatti. He's already won a Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Comedy. Our producer, Sam Brigger, spoke with Giamatti last month. Here's Sam.
In The Holdovers, Paul Giamatti plays a pompous and lonely classics professor named Paul Hunnam at a New England boarding school for boys in 1970. He's almost universally disliked by other faculty members and by students because of his impossibly high academic standards and merciless grading. The students also mock him behind his back because he has a lazy eye and bad body odor. The body odor is uncontrollable, the result of a rare disease commonly known as fish odor syndrome. But he doesn't do himself any favors in the way he treats his students, as he does here in this scene, handing out his students' graded final exams.
I can tell by your faces that many of you are shocked at the outcome. I, on the other hand, am not, because I have had the misfortune of teaching you this semester, and even with my ocular limitations, I witness firsthand your glazed, uncomprehending expressions.
Sir, I don't understand.
That's glaringly apparent.
No, it's... I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
I'm supposed to go to Cornell.
Unlikely.
Hunnam also flunked a former student, the son of a major donor, dashing his chances at going to Princeton and going against the wishes of the school's headmaster. The headmaster decides to punish him. Hunnam must babysit students that have nowhere to go over winter vacation. At first, he has a handful of kids under his care, but most are rescued by one of their fathers, who whisks them off in a helicopter for a ski vacation, leaving only one, a smart but surly junior named Angus Tully, played by Dominic Sessa, whose mother and stepfather can't be reached to get permission for him to leave, as they're off on an overdue honeymoon. Hunnam and Angus make up a trio with the school's head cook, Mary, played by Davine Joy Randolph. Mary is mourning her son Marcus, who was a scholarship student at the boarding school but was killed in Vietnam. These three broken and lonely people, thrust together haphazardly, find a bond growing between them as they face the loneliest holiday. This is Paul Giamatti's second starring role in a movie by Alexander Payne. The first was the 2004 film Sideways. Paul Giamatti has also starred in American Splendor, Private Life, and Win Win. He played the title role in the HBO miniseries John Adams and starred in the Showtime series Billions, which ended its run last October after 7 seasons. Paul Giamatti, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So Alexander Payne has said that he wrote the role of Paul Hunnam for you. What was it about the character that interested you?
Well, everything about it. I mean, first of all, it was the fact that he was going to direct it that interested me about it. You know, I would sort of do anything he wanted me to do.
Yeah.
I think I found the setting interesting. I found the time period interesting. I found the Christmas story aspect of it, the sort of Scrooge-like story of sort of kind of redemption and change and rebirth and selflessness interesting. The character was really wonderful. The language is wonderful. I think I found the character quite touching because I thought he's a guy who, as far as he's concerned, is doing absolutely the right thing. He's created this sort of persona for himself that feels very comfortable and safe to him at this place and conveying classical values in this way. And he's created this kind of fantasy world for himself. And it comes apart a little bit as the story goes on. This guy sort of has to let go of a lot of his shtick in some ways.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting.
Is it tricky to play a role where in the movie the character is disliked by lots of people, but you have to play that person in a way that the audience can empathize with?
Yeah, that's always sort of difficult. I mean, I think, you know, he's lived in this strange, rarefied world, in this world of intellect, and, you know, he's hobbled by his own intellect. It's, you know, the thing that makes him feel superior is the thing that keeps separating him, too. And, right. You know, he just doesn't go about anything the right way. But he's not wrong a lot of the time. So hopefully that's comes across as somewhat appealing. But also I thought, you know, he's somewhat self-aware. He takes pleasure in his own nasty wit in a way that hopefully is funny to people and makes him somewhat appealing.
So this movie takes place at a boarding school in 1970. You actually were a student at a boarding school in the 80s. You,
yes.
You were a day student.
Yeah.
So a decade later, although I bet these places don't change that quickly. And you said that in preparation for the role, you thought a lot about your past and the people in it. I'm assuming the sort of people that went to your school. Mm. What did you take from those memories?
I did go to a school like that 10 years on from when the movie set. And it wasn't, I don't think, very different. There were girls there.
Well, that's a big difference.
Big difference, yes. I'll say that. But a lot of those men were still there. And for the most part, they were men like this, and these old school guys. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just the school. My whole life I grew up around teachers and academia. My father was a professor. My mother was a teacher. My grandparents were all teachers and professors. So teachers and teaching were around me a lot. But for sure, being a day student at one of those places is different than living there. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways it could probably give me an anthropological perspective on it that maybe you don't have if you live there. Mm. So I had some distance on it to be able to observe it in some ways. But absolutely, I mean, it was an interesting part to play. It's an interesting movie for me to watch because I think there was a ton of unconscious memories affecting my system, and I was ending up calling up all kinds of people I wasn't even aware of. I was watching it and thinking, oh, my God, I just reminded myself of this colleague of my father's. I didn't even realize I was doing that. I had a friend who wrote to me and said, I went to high school with him, and he said, oh, you were clearly doing the head librarian in this whole thing. And I thought, I didn't even think about the head librarian, but he's right. I do seem like the head librarian. So, I mean, there was a deep well of people I was drawing on for this thing, even unconsciously. Some of it was conscious. I had a biology teacher who was very much like this guy, and I thought about him a lot. And I thought about these men a lot, you know, and they're interesting characters. They're complicated, interesting guys.
Your character has a lazy eye, and you've sworn not to say how that was created, which is fine. I won't ask you about that.
Okay.
But you also, you have this rare disorder whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce, but it's commonly known as fish odor syndrome, where the character's body is unable to break down this chemical and has just a really unfortunate body odor issue. So, you know, as an audience, we only have so many senses to experience the movie. But unfortunately, I guess in this case. But I was wondering, do you think about that in your character as you're acting them? Like, I'm assuming you didn't spray yourself with some
Odor. There would be people who would worry, who would have, codfish cakes in their pockets and stuff like that. I thought about doing that just to sort of mess with Dom in particular, but I didn't do that. I mean, there's ways in which, yes, the body odor thing is I keep, there's a kind of, saying in theater, particularly when you do Shakespeare, that if you're playing the king, you don't have to play the king. Everyone around you plays that you're the king. Mm. And so I don't need to play that I smell like fish. Everybody around me needs to play that I smell like fish. He's used to smelling like fish. Right. So to a certain extent, they need to do it. There was actually some thinking in this movie. It was interesting with the hair and makeup people. They said to me in particular, can't believe it. Bathe as little as possible if you can. And I said, okay. So, and I think it probably helps, to give me an appearance of sort of, there's a tactile sense probably about the guy that comes across
sort of
because
unkempt
of that. And sort of, and so that helps too.
So, I rewatched Sideways in preparation for this interview, and I was thinking there was probably going to be some similarities between the character Paul Hunnam and Miles from Sideways. But rewatching, there's actually a lot of similarities. Both are misanthropes who feel superior to a lot of people they encounter. Both are would-be writers, although they're teaching to kids and not necessarily always happy about that. Both have a pretty severe drinking problem. And in some ways, you could see the character from The Holdovers at what might happen to Miles from Sideways if he doesn't end up with his love interest at the end of that movie.
It is interesting. And, it's a subject that both Alexander and I kind of danced around and didn't really talk about. And it's very funny that we didn't, because certainly you could see I could see all these similarities too. It'd be better asked to him how much he was consciously doing that, how much he meant to do that, that in some sense you really are seeing a similar guy at a different stage of his life.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. There's lots of similarities. There's ways in which it didn't feel the same to me, though, too. He doesn't feel like the same guy to me. He feels like I like this guy better than the other guy. Mm. I feel like he's got more kind of backbone, sort of. He's less self-pitying. He's more sort of, I think he's funnier. I think he's kind of... I just think he's got more going on than the other guy. I liked him better as a person and a presence. I found him more fun to play. I liked it. Maybe that could be the same guy 20 years on that I'm enjoying. I don't know. But I could definitely see it. And in some ways, I remembered thinking at a certain point, it's a funny way. Maybe it is like sort of the sequel to Sideways that would never get made as technically a sequel to Sideways. I don't know.
Right.
But Alexander would be a good guy to ask about it. But in a funny way, we kind of avoided ever talking about it.
I can't imagine a Sideways 2, but...
Yeah, exactly. No, you can't. You really can't. So maybe this is some sort of extension of it, yeah.
Well, your character, Miles, is a lover of wine, particularly Pinot Noir. In fact, that movie probably increased the cost of Pinot Noir across the country. But I wanted to play a clip where your love interest, Maya, played by Virginia Madsen, asks you why you love that wine so much. And, your character, Miles, is talking about wine, but he's also really talking about himself. So let's hear that.
Can I ask you a personal question, Miles?
Sure.
Why are you so into Pinot? I mean, it's like a thing with you.
I don't know. It's a hard grape to grow, as you know, right? It's thin-skinned, temperamental, ripens early. It's, it's not a survivor like Cabernet, which can just grow anywhere and thrive even when it's neglected. No, Pinot needs constant care and attention. And in fact, it can only grow in these really specific little tucked away corners of the world. the most patient and nurturing of growers can do it, really. Only somebody who really takes the time to understand Pinot's potential can then coax it into its fullest expression. And then, I mean, oh, its flavors, they're just the most haunting and brilliant and thrilling and subtle and ancient on the planet.
That's a scene from Sideways with our guest Paul Giamatti and Virginia Madsen. First of all, I just love how Virginia Madsen prefaces that question with, can I ask you a personal question?
I was just thinking the same thing, how funny that is, that that's the deeply personal question. Yeah. It's very funny.
So do you remember doing that scene?
Yes, very much so. I remember it vividly, yeah.
So can you talk about, I mean, I'm sure when you saw the script, you're like, oh, this is a really good speech.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good scene, you know, and I thought it was a nice speech, yeah. And, you know, it's he's not aware so much as she is of what they're really talking
right,
about.
Right.
You know, she's the one who's much more aware than him. And so she sort of picks it up and really brings it home with a beautiful speech that kind of freaks him out, because then he realizes what they're actually talking about. And it hits him, and, you know, he's really fallen for this woman. But I remember shooting it absolutely. I mean, it was a wonderful, I remember every second of making that movie, probably because I was very nervous, but also because it was a really special experience. I mean, it just felt, I'd never done anything like it before, and until Holdovers, I'd never really done anything quite like it again, because of the sort of intimate atmosphere that he creates. And that was a very lovely, quiet, intimate evening that the whole crew was having, you know. And it was, I remember it vividly, and she was wonderful in it and just absolutely entrancing in it. And I remember it very well.
So do you recall what it was about acting that first appealed to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to articulate. I mean, I had always loved play acting. I mean, from the time I was a very little kid, dressing up and being a character, and particularly as a kid, sort of monstrous and grotesque things. I was very drawn to sort of like werewolves and mummies and things like that, and sort of strange characters, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I enjoyed sort of always the school plays and stuff. But I think when I did it in high school, there was a kind of sense of connection that and communication that was almost shockingly joyous that I felt. It was not the easiest place in the world, that place. Mm-hmm. And they're rough environments. And and I felt a kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, not that I felt seen or something, but I felt connected to people, to the other actors and to the, and I felt a sense of communal effort that was really, really exciting to me. And as much as playing the character and getting laughs and doing all those things was great, when I think about it now, I think it was genuinely this feeling of connection, and I can't articulate it much better than that.
Was there a point when you were thinking, well, this is something I should maybe consider pursuing?
Well, later, yeah. I mean, I went to Yale University, I went to college, and then did it a lot extracurricularly and sort of fell into that. I wasn't a major or anything there, but I loved it, and it became obsessive to me. And I left, and it was shortly after that I think I started realizing it was something that I wanted to do very badly, and I should.
Your dad died at the age of 51 from a heart attack. You've said that it was because of your father's sudden death that you decided to become an actor. That before that you were thinking maybe becoming an academic.
Well, you know, it's all hard for me to sort of be entirely clear about it. I mean, like I say, it was the thing I loved doing the most. Mm-hmm. I think I thought, well, I should do something else because, you know, being an actor, I just didn't, you know, but I loved it. And his dying was a very profoundly destabilizing thing for everybody in my family. He was a very solid, grounded figure in the world. And for him to disappear in an instant at that young an age freaked me out, obviously. And I think it did impel me to go, I'm going to pursue and do the thing that I love to do.
Because possibly your time is short.
Sure.
You should really just,
you know, and also my father had instilled that in me, you know. And so all of a sudden his absence made that, his urging me always to do that throughout my life, somehow even more present in my mind. And I thought, I'm going to do the thing I love to do. It's what he would have said to me to do. And so I did.
So your dad left academia and became the commissioner for Major League Baseball. And it sounds like he loved baseball.
He did.
A lot of his life. Did that also make you feel like that you should pursue the things that you really love?
Yes, I think so. I think that was also a part of it. I can remember my dad when he left the presidency of Yale, and he sort of took kind of a year off. You know, he wasn't really doing much, and I was in college, and I think the baseball thing sort of came through, and I can remember him in this very kind of giddy way, funny giddy way, saying to me, well, I'm thinking about going back to teaching, but they've asked me to go, you know, they've asked me if I'm interested in going to baseball. What do you think? And I was like, geez. I don't know. And I was a little bit like, geez, I don't know. Do the safe thing and go back to teaching. And he was like, no, I think I got to do baseball. And I was like, yeah, okay, do baseball. And he did. And it was very much him doing a thing. And I remembered thinking, oh, yes, of course, he couldn't have done anything but go into baseball. Yeah. The guy was out of his mind with joy. So, I mean, he was out of his mind that he could go to baseball games anytime. And, you know, I mean, it was pure oxygen to the guy. So I don't know how I ever could have thought, like, don't do that.
Well, Paul Giamatti, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Giamatti is nominated for Best Actor for his starring role in the film The Holdovers. He spoke with our producer, Sam Brigger.